Welcome to the Alliance Party After Dark, a podcast for the politically aware brought to you by the Alliance Party. This podcast was recorded on September 5, 2019. My name is Dan Schaefer, producer of the Alliance Party After Dark, and on this show, M. Lloyd Johnson, our moderator, kicks off a four-part series where we hear from the national chair of the Alliance Party, Mr. Jim Rex. Now, Jim has an interesting background. He co-founded and chaired the American Party of South Carolina, and he was the last Democrat to win a statewide election in South Carolina when elected as the 16th state superintendent of education in 2006. Prior to becoming superintendent, Jim held a variety of leadership positions, including the dean of education at Winthrop University and at Coastal Carolina University, vice president for university advancement at the University of South Carolina, and president of Columbia College in South Carolina. He began his career as a high school English teacher and football coach. He earned a PhD in curriculum and instruction from the University of Toledo. We had so many questions for Jim. We recorded nearly 2 hours with him, so we broke everything up into four episodes of about a half hour each. You're listening to the first of these episodes. So if you're driving your car while listening to this podcast, strap in, keep your eyes on the road, and get ready for a fascinating ride as we get the straight scoop from a leader of one of America's fastest growing political parties. Take it away, M. Lloyd Johnson.
Jim, how should candidates and voters view your answers as it relates to the Alliance Party's positions?
Well, in some cases, depending on the question, Lloyd, I'll be able to say this is the approach the Alliance Party expects its candidates to take on a particular issue or topic. In other cases, I will just give you an example, I hope, of how we want our candidates to approach a problem on their way to finding a solution. And so I'll try to explain that to you and your listeners, but we have core values that the party stands for. We have some very specific positions and expectations of our candidates, but we also recognize that candidates need a certain amount of flexibility because their primary objective and responsibility is to represent their constituents.
So how does the Alliance Party address issues differently than other parties in light of that comment?
Well, we're not driven by a particular ideology. We don't have a party whip that tells candidates you must vote this way on an issue or you must vote that way. What we're really doing with the Alliance Party and its candidates is putting up for election pragmatic, patriotic problem solvers. And we don't want people to be driven by ideology. We want them to be driven by a desire to find solutions and to represent their constituents' interests. And those are uniform in some cases across the country, but in other cases they differ depending upon the district or the state that this candidate is running in. So that's the degree of flexibility we're trying to give them.
With that in mind, there are a lot of issues that are at the forefront of voters' minds. And I'd like to ask you about some of the more popular ones and your take on how they could be approached. First, and this is a big one, how can the Alliance Party tackle unemployment and the lack of a decent, livable pay? Or is the economy just so good to a degree that this is no longer an issue and that we really need to focus on and we can move on to other things?
Oh, it's a big issue, and it's one that's going to get even more critical because of automation and other influences that will ultimately change the workplace for millions of not just of Americans, but people all over the planet. The opportunity to do constructive, worthwhile work will probably at some point in the future be viewed as a privilege. And at the moment, I think the questions and the issues and the controversy are mostly whether you can find a job and whether when you find a job, you can make a livable wage by engaging in that work. And so more and more, I think Americans and certainly our party would be in this position. We believe that if someone works at a legal job, an occupation, full-time, 40 hours or more a week, and plays by the rules, you know, abides the laws, is a good citizen, that person should not live below the poverty line. You know, people who work hard who play by the rules should not be living in poverty. Otherwise, how do we provide incentives for work and good citizenship if the people who don't work are as well off as the people who do? So I think we're, as a society, we're trying to figure that out through appeals for minimum wages. Generally, I think a living wage, a minimum wage, is something that most of our candidates would support, but they would want it to be geographical. In other words, it should be tied to the cost of living. So a livable wage in one part of the country may not be the same number as a livable wage in another part of the country where the cost of living is higher. So it needs to be pragmatic, it needs to be practical, but at the same time, we should reward work and we should reward good behavior. Otherwise, we're going to have a society that no one will want to be a part of.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And one thing that's ironic is supposedly our economy is doing well now, but there's still a lot of people who are suffering. And a good percentage, it seems like there are a lot of jobs, but they're not jobs that are a livable wage. So is our economy really, is it fair for us to describe our current economy as robust right now? Would that maybe just be something that's in the eye of the beholder?
Yeah, I think it depends. You're exactly right. It depends, Lloyd, on the definition for successful economy or, as you said, a robust economy. For example, if your main criterion is the stock market, and you know, there's a relatively small percentage of Americans who have any kind of significant investments in the stock market, then you're doing well. The stock market's doing well. You know, if you're living off an inheritance from past generations, you're doing well also. And if you're the kind of American who had access to high quality education and you were able to go on, especially to college, university, and post-secondary opportunities, the odds are you're doing pretty well also. But there are large numbers of Americans who are working very hard, who are doing very poorly in terms of their living standards, their access to health, their access to equal opportunities for quality education, et cetera. So it depends on the eye of the beholder. In this case, it depends upon the eye of the particular American or American family that you're talking about.
And we're going to be circling back to this. So keep listening in. We are going to be coming back to the education system and what education can do for us, because that's important to, well, just about everybody listening. Moving on to something that is related to the economy and how well we can handle it is healthcare. How much does the Alliance Party or you personally think that we as a government should be helping people? Is there a point where the government could be doing too much, like more than is economically feasible?
Well, I think that our government, when you look at our Constitution and the things that we talk about in the Bill of Rights, for example, we say that all men are created equal, which implies that there should be some equality, at least of opportunity. And I think most of the Alliance Party leadership and candidates would agree that we should provide equal access to opportunity, not guarantee success, not guarantee the outcomes, but guarantee that everybody gets a legitimate shot at being successful in this economy and in this society. You mentioned education. That's certainly historically one of the ways we've tried to do that, and we're not doing it adequately. But there are other ways too, just in terms of having access to healthcare, for example. That's very important, especially for children, young children, babies, mothers. If you don't have adequate healthcare, you don't start out with equal opportunities either. Cultural activities, being exposed to the arts. There are lots of things that represent equal opportunity that the government could play a role in. But it should still be based, after that's happened, hopefully, on effort and skill and ability. And that's, I think, what most Americans would think would be a fair approach.
And could you just elaborate a little bit more? What does equal opportunity to healthcare mean? If I'm, because that's a phrase that it might throw some people off.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think one of the things our society has been wrestling with, and I think we've come to a consensus here in recent years, is that access to quality healthcare is a human right in America, not a privilege. That your access to healthcare that can save your life or save the life of your child should not be based upon your socioeconomic level or the kind of job you have or the amount of education you've had. So assuming that that is the consensus in our country, and I think it is, and by the way, I think it's the consensus in most developed nations around the world now, that access to quality healthcare is a human right, then we have to find a way in America to make it affordable and accessible. And we also need to get smarter about the costs involved, especially in terms of emphasizing preventative health care, which is, by all experts' opinions who study this, the best way to save money on health care in this country or any other country. In this country, for example, obesity kills hundreds of thousands of Americans every year, indirectly or directly, because of heart disease, diabetes, and other related diseases. So if we got serious about preventative health care, we could save a lot of money, and we could also afford to come up with a system that makes it accessible and affordable for all Americans.
And that was a great answer. I was just kind of wondering, too, like, what does Jim mean by this? But it's something that I think a lot of us think about. So I'm thank you very much for that clarification.
You've been listening to an interview with Jim Rex, the national chair of the Alliance Party. We will return after a short break.
The two-party system that we've got is broken.
The choices are awful. All we see is lies, cheating, deceit.
You could say it about both parties. Neither one really stands for anything except acquiring and exercising power.
The idea was to give the power to the people, or the people have given the power away. And that's where the system broke.
Government and our political system was designed to be malleable, you know, not rigid, not ossified, not always gridlocked.
Absolute power does corrupt, absolutely, and that's why the founders set the system up to avoid having concentrated power in the executive and in the national branch.
The founding documents are the best, it's the best government so far that we've come up with. We're just not doing it.
You know, it's tribalism, basically. If you're not in my tribe, then you're a bad person. You could say the sky is blue, and I'm going to say, no, it's green.
I think it's right out of a 1930s era playbook where if you can divide people, make them feel like something's being taken from them, probably pays well for them to make sure that everybody's divided because, in essence, it keeps them in office, it keeps them in power, it keeps them employed.
The amount of money that's involved in politics, it is crazy.
And Obama's a smart guy, but not even he could, he wasn't going to do it either. And I was like, okay, that's it. If he can't do it, it's not going to happen because that's when I knew that the lobbyists and the corporate interests, the outside private interests that really have a hand in making sure that our political system doesn't work, I knew that they had won. And I said, okay, third party is the way to go.
What I think we're trying to do here is to make systemic change. Yeah, we need the right people, but there's not any one person, any one charismatic personality that's going to bring about the change that we so desperately need in this country.
Our biggest goals are election reform.
Knock down those barriers that have been built in the ballot access game by the state governments.
Fixing the dark money.
Getting good health care out there.
We need more women. We need more minorities. We need more occupations and backgrounds.
We don't have set paradigms and beliefs. We just want to solve problems. So we're open books. We're data sensitive. We want data. We want to solve solutions that help the most people.
Let's forget about where we disagree. Let's start with where do we agree.
Let facts be facts and let truth be truth and afford people the opportunity to go and find the information they need.
We require term limits of all of our candidates.
Now, if you have more choices and competition, just like any free market enterprise, competition is going to give you a better product.
Focus on innovation and really learning on a local level.
Free press and educating people in an unbiased way.
Protecting and controlling the deficit.
With respect and courtesy.
Honesty through transparency.
Openness and transparency.
Transparency. I think that's incredibly important in a number of areas, but especially in finances, so that voters can connect the dots
We want to leave this place in a better condition than we left it for the next generations, pure and simple. Not just my children, all our American kids.
We need to educate every single individual in this country so every individual has tools they need to succeed in life.
Ultimately, that's what we're doing this for, what we can help the American people be. Not what we say they can be, but what they want to be, and we'll get our party to that point.
We're supposed to help each other rise up, enlighten each other, and start by being civil and respecting other people's opinions.
There's nobody left. We have to do it.
There's right and there's wrong. Nobody owns it. You know, JFK, I believe, was quoted as saying something to the effect of, we don't need to look for the Republican answer or the Democratic answer. We need to look for the correct answer. And that's the types of conversations we're not having. As a people, are we doing what we should be doing?
We're back. We're talking with Jim Rex, the national chair of the Alliance Party. We've been discussing a number of important contemporary issues, including unemployment and health care. Now let's spend some time on an urgent issue facing America these days, immigration and political asylum. Take it away, M. Lloyd Johnson.
The next topic I'd like to go over, immigration is a hot topic right now. How can we help not just asylum seekers, but people who may be fleeing their country because of an economic crisis or they're trying to get away from a country that's violent and not safe to live in?
Well, it's a perplexing question, an issue right now, especially right now for most Americans. And we're a unique country in some ways. There are a few other countries like us. Australia would be one where the country had some indigenous people, but the country was largely unpopulated in the early years of our development as a nation. And so all of us, and we all know this, unless we were Native Americans, are the descendants of immigrants. And immigration has always been a part of who we are. And we've been proud of it, you know, the melting pot, the diversity we have in this country. And when you look at the people of achievement in America, all of them are either immigrants or recent descendants of immigrants. So now we have a situation in this country where we're concerned about our borders. And I might point out, we're not concerned about our northern border, which is much longer than our southern border. So we need to ask ourselves as Americans, why are we more concerned about our southern border than our northern border? Well, there are a number of reasons for that, but one is that our northern neighbor has a robust, progressive economy and government that provides a fairly high quality of life for its citizens. So there aren't a bunch of people coming from Canada who are trying to cross illegally. South of us, especially in Central America, but even in South America, there are lots of countries that are not doing well by their citizens. High poverty, high crime, lots of issues. And they seek not just asylum, but they seek a better way of life in our country, just like our ancestors did, all of us who are descendants of immigrants. The question is, how many of those people can we take, and what is the process we should use for determining who gets in and who is denied access? I think most Americans support the idea of a strong border. It ought to be our choice as a nation in terms of who enters and who doesn't. It ought to be a rational, humane choice, but it should be a choice. And there are lots of reasons for having a strong border. One of them that isn't talked about very much is the threat, which is a real threat, of pandemics. We have lots of contagious diseases, which medical science is barely keeping up with. And in a crowded world, it's only a matter of time until we have a contagious disease that turns out to be very deadly and that we may not have any vaccine or medical response for. So that's one of the reasons, along with drugs and crime and too many immigrants, that requires a strong border. But along with a strong border, we also have to have a strong national commitment to a process for deciding who comes in and who doesn't, and a humane way of dealing with those people, whether they're accepted or rejected. And we don't have that. We don't have that consensus about what that process should be. And it's because our politics is so gridlocked and so dysfunctional that we can't make decisions about a lot of things, including that very important one dealing with immigration. So I think the answers are fairly simple if we could just, you know, get our elected officials to sit down and pragmatically look at what are the numbers of immigrants we need. And by the way, we need immigrants. We need them because we have a declining population and birth rate. And there are a number of nations in Europe and elsewhere that desperately need immigrants because their population is graying and there aren't enough young people to take care of the older people. And since I'm in that latter category, I'm particularly interested in making sure we have enough, you know, working young people, and some of them would need to be immigrants. So I think we can come up with a national, rational policy for how many immigrants we need and want, and a humane way to determine who we say yes to and who we say no to, and a strong border that will implement those decisions.
And since we do want to be humane, but we're still getting an overflow where we don't have the capacity for all the undocumented immigrants who are coming in, due to desperation or whatever, they want to circumvent the system. But what do we do to handle this difficult crisis when it comes to children, and that includes infants being taken from their parents? Sometimes military spouses are being deported back because they came here without documentation. They came here through what you know, basically some would describe as illegally. Those are just some examples. So when we have an issue of just not having the capacity or not having the funding because politically it's pointing to something when we need funding for something, how do we handle a capacity that we really aren't equipped to handle? What's a humane solution that we could come up with, and a realistic one as well?
Well, in one of the wealthiest nations in the world, once we identify a priority, we can always find money for it. You know, we spend more money on our military than the next 10 nations combined. Everyone who looks at our military industrial complex agrees that we have a very inefficient way of spending money. If we took a fraction of that, just a small fraction of that, and put it into facilities and border enforcement, you know, we would deal with that part of the problem. But the other examples you gave, Lloyd, about how we handle people who are already in the country illegally and whether we should provide them a reasonable pathway to citizenship, and especially their children or their spouses, you mentioned military service as one example, where you have someone who has used military service as a way of gaining citizenship. And it would seem to most Americans that's a legitimate way. If you're already here and you want to volunteer for the military and you serve with distinction, or just you play by the rules, that should help you move towards citizenship. And if you're married, certainly somebody shouldn't snatch your spouse from you and send them back to a country that they may never have even seen before because they were born in the United States. Those are the kinds of examples that I think the vast majority of Americans would say a humane, rational approach to immigration would address in a way that would be more humane than we're doing now sporadically. Again, I keep going back to the fact that we have a dysfunctional Congress, a dysfunctional political system that doesn't allow us to come up with answers to these kinds of problems that the vast majority of Americans would agree with. So what we do is we come up with these sort of stopgap approaches that different small segments of our society agree vehemently with or vehemently against. And that's really not engaging the majority of Americans in the decision-making process. Other countries do this. There's no reason why we can't. We just need to make our political system functional.
You're right. That makes sense. There's also the issue of human trafficking and things that we need to do at our border. stretches of land where we don't have enough agents to handle the human trafficking. And I talked to a friend just the other day, and this hurt to hear, but there is issue of a lot of rape and a lot of murder. And there are people who are falsely posing as parents. And the Democratic take seems to say it's been, we're not going to do a DNA test because that's discriminating against the people who are saying that they're the parents. So what are some things that we need to do to address the human trafficking concern?
Well, again, I think if we had a rational, not just humane, but you're talking about the rational side of things.
Right.
What is the reason you want to come into the United States of America? Are you who you say you are? Are the young people with you really your children or not? Do you have a legitimate reason that you can document as to why you need to seek asylum? I mean, are you really in danger of your lives or your children's lives if you go back to where you came from? Those kind of questions are answerable questions if you have the resources in place, the counselors, the investigators, the processing units to find out who these people are and what their real reason is for wanting to enter the United States and whether they're being truthful or not. We do not provide those kinds of resources. So what we're doing is, by happen chance, we're letting some people in who we would otherwise not want to say yes to, and we're precluding others who we would, if we could find out the answers to those questions, who we would welcome with open arms. But because we haven't put the resources, human and otherwise, at the borders to implement a rational immigration policy, we're not satisfying anybody. We're getting people we shouldn't get, and we're excluding people who have a legitimate need and should be admitted into this country just like our ancestors were, and who would be contributing members if they were allowed to come in.
You know, I'd have to agree. That's a very intelligent and common sense answer all in one. This next question, I kind of think that our listeners can guess what the answer would be, but because it's going to be a question some people have, I'll go ahead and ask it. We do have angel families who have lost someone due to murder from an undocumented immigrant, in many cases who has already been charged with a violent offense. The statistics that are interesting related to that is, and this is in rank order, the person who is the biggest threat to you would be a fellow citizen. The second biggest threat to you would be an undocumented immigrant. And then the least threat is the documented immigrant who came through transparent channels. So one argument is, well, if they're undocumented, since they're safer than our citizens, even though it would be safer if they were transparent, they're still safer than our citizens, so we should just let them in. But then the side that a lot of these angel families have is, hey, I lost someone in my family. Had we had a transparent system where they came in through the proper channels, yeah, a citizen might be a bigger threat, but an undocumented immigrant versus a documented immigrant, the threat leans towards the undocumented immigrant. So how would we address, what would be the common sense approach to that?
Well, first of all, you know, a criminal is a criminal, regardless of what kind of papers they're carrying. And we should treat them, you know, depending on the degree of their criminality, we should make sure that they're punished for that criminal act, whether they're a documented citizen or whether they're an undocumented immigrant. Your statistic's interesting, Lloyd, because when you said the chances of a fellow citizen doing something to me or my family is much greater than an undocumented immigrant is not only true, but it's true by a significant magnitude. In other words, there are many millions, many more millions of my citizens who potentially could be a threat to me than there are undocumented immigrants. You know what I'm saying? There are fewer undocumented immigrants than there are American citizens. So people need to keep that in mind. The chances of me being robbed or mugged or raped or shot by a citizen is much greater than by an undocumented immigrant, unless I happen to live in close proximity to the southern border. Then those statistics may change. But for most Americans, that is the reality. That doesn't make it any less of a problem, especially for the families that are, as you said, that are the victims of that violence. You know, we have more incarcerated people in the United States per capita than any other society. So we have a lot of people in prison. Some are more important in serious crimes than others. I would think that someone who is an undocumented immigrant who commits a crime, not a violent crime like murder, but, you know, robbery, burglary, that kind of thing, should be deported. I mean, why put them in a prison system that's going to cost us money and that is not a very good system to begin with? Let's put them back in the country they came from. And that only works if you have a strong border to make sure they can't come back in again. But so they ought to be punished. They should either be put in prison or suffer the penalty prescribed by law in this country. Or if they're an illegal immigrant, I think deportation is another option if it's not a violent, serious crime. So, you know, I think we're supposed to all be equal under the law. In this country, we're supposed to be a nation of laws, not of people. And if you're an American citizen, you should suffer the consequences of your act and your behavior. If you're an undocumented citizen, you should also suffer it. But you would have the additional option of sending them back to the country that they illegally came from.
And lastly, on that topic of immigration, are there things that both major camps are unwilling to look at that we might be missing on immigration?
Well, I think both camps are using it as a political football to one extent or another. And, you know, one thing about a political football, you can't kick it back and forth unless you keep it inflated. And both parties are not particularly interested in solving the immigration problem. They want to use it for political purposes. They want to cater to their own particular base or bases with their, you know, their bias or their approach to the problem with no real solutions in sight. So one thing that both parties have in common is not only their inability to find solutions, but really their reluctance to find solutions because they can use immigration for political gain, and both parties are doing it.
We've been listening to an interview between our moderator, M. Lloyd Johnson, and the national chair of the Alliance Party, Mr. Jim Rex. Unfortunately, we're about out of time for this episode. Please stay tuned to the Alliance Party website for subsequent episodes in this interview series. Or better yet, subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or Google or Spotify. All content for this podcast is copyright the Alliance Party. Views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Alliance Party. This podcast is a production of the Alliance Party, a decades-long movement of fiscally conservative, moderate, accountable, and reasoned independents, former Democrats, former Republicans, and alienated voters who demand that our elected officials work in the spirit of nonpartisanship for all constituents and provide a better future for our country. This podcast was made possible by your donations to the Alliance Party. If you'd like to help sponsor this podcast directly, get in touch with us through our website at theallianceparty.com. If you'd like to join the Alliance Party, visit our website at theallianceparty.com. Drop in, see what we're all about, and get involved. Volunteer your time, make a donation, or submit an article or blog, or run for office. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Dan Schaefer, producer of the Alliance Party After Dark, and on behalf of our moderator, M. Lloyd Johnson, have a wonderful evening, a great weekend, and we hope you drop in for our next show. Be safe and be aware.